Good morning. I would like to welcome everyone back to the symposium today as we kick things off with our first panel of the day, The Anti-Federalists, Planting the Seeds of American Populism. It is my privilege to introduce the moderator for our first panel, Judge Lisa Branch of the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Judge Branch was appointed to the bench in 2018. She received her BA from Davidson College and her JD from Emory University School of Law. Judge Branch started her legal career as a clerk to Judge Owen Forrester on the Northern District of Georgia, and then entered private practice in Atlanta. She also spent time working in government as an associate general counsel for rules and legislation at the Department of Homeland Security, and later as a counselor to the administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, Office of Management and Budget. Prior to joining the federal bench, Judge Branch was a judge on the Court of Appeals of Georgia. Judge Branch, it is an honor to have you join us today, and with that, I will pass it on to you to introduce our panel today.
Thank you, Stephen, for that kind introduction. And I also want to thank the Federalist Society and also the University of Virginia School of Law Federalist Society chapter for hosting this year's National Student Symposium. This is my second time attending a student symposium as a moderator. The first time was out in Arizona, and while that was a lovely trip, travel is much easier when you stay in your own time zone. So I'm grateful for that. And as a moment of moderator privilege, I would like to note that it was very important for me to attend this year because one of my future clerks is a 3L here at UVA, the man who just introduced me, Stephen Joseph. And another one of my future clerks made the trek from Duke Law School as well, and he is here, John Addy. And so I've been so pleased to have the opportunity to visit with both of them during this student symposium. And now, welcome to the second panel discussion of the conference, which is titled The Anti-Federalists, Planting Seeds of American Populism. To what extent were the anti-federalists the precursors of the populist movement in the United States? To some extent, the similarities and differences depend on how you see the two movements and how monolithic you think they are. Looking at their broad principles, they have common concerns. Populists are seen as anti-elite and anti-establishment, distrustful of government officials, especially those making a career out of it. They feel their voices aren't heard. Anti-federalists were concerned about the concentration of power in the federal government and that government officials would become permanent aristocracy. As the anti-federalist writing under the pseudonym Cato said, "You risk too much by indispensably placing trusts of the greatest magnitude into the hands of individuals whose ambition for power and aggrandizement will oppress and grind you." But general principles only get you so far. Can you really compare the focused debate among our nation's founders with the amorphous political movements? Our distinguished panelists will address these similarities and differences during our discussion this morning. I will briefly introduce our three panelists and the order in which they will speak. Please note that you will find their more detailed biographies on the Federalist Society website. After my introductions, each of the panelists will deliver their remarks. I will then engage the panel in discussion before we turn to you, the audience, for Q&A. Stephen, I do expect you to ask a question. Let me start with our first presentation will be given by Professor Michelle Kunmiller, who is an assistant professor of constitutional law and political theory at Old Dominion University. Her research focuses on the American judiciary, ancient and American political thought, literature, and the role of moderation in the health of political and legal communities. Her current book project, Moderating the Republic, is on the rhetoric of Atticus Finch. And I do have to point out one of her writings that interested me, particularly as a Georgia native. In 2014, she wrote, "The devil is in all the details, not just in Georgia," for the First Amendment Law Review. Not only am I a native Atlantan, but as a Charlie Daniels fan, that title certainly interested me. She obtained her JD, her MA, and her PhD at Notre Dame. She will answer two questions for us today. can we identify common ground between the anti-federalists and populism? And does their common ground justify characterizing the anti-federalists as the philosophical ancestors of populism? Our second panelist is Professor Edward White, a law professor here at UVA Law. He's a graduate of Yale University and Harvard Law, and he joined the UVA faculty in 1972 after a clerkship with Chief Justice Earl Warren of the Supreme Court of the United States, and a year as a visiting scholar at the American Bar Foundation. He has his 14 published books have won numerous honors and awards, including final listing for the Pulitzer Prize in History. And again, not to continue to harp on my Atlanta native status, but one of his books held particular interest for me, and in 1996, right after the Braves won a World Series, I would note, he wrote Creating the National Pastime, Baseball Transforms Itself, 1903 to 1953. And especially that brings it home to me because we are, again, enjoying our rule as the reigning World Series champions. He will discuss the relationship between originalism and anachronism in his exploration of whether the anti-federalists were yesterday's populace. And last but not least, Professor Amar will close out the panelists' remarks. He is a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He joined the Yale faculty in 1985 at the age of 26. And he's Yale's only current active professor to have won the university's unofficial triple crown, the Sterling Chair for Scholarship, the Devane Medal for Teaching, and the Lamar Award for Alumni Service. He is the author of more than 100 law review articles and several books. His latest book, The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation, 1760 to 1840, has just been published, and he co-hosts a weekly podcast, America's Constitution. He will explore how two of the anti-federalist criticisms of the Constitution were especially helpful and in a certain way populist: the lack of a Bill of Rights and a concern that the House was too small to be generally representative. And so with those introductions, I will turn it over to our first speaker.
Thank you all. I just want to start by saying that I am happy and very, very honored to be here. I hope that I produce, I don't know, 10% of the scholarship over my career as either of my co-panelists. But setting that aside, I'm really just looking forward to today's talks because this is the grand American tradition of talking about what it means for the people to engage in good self-government. And as lawyers and law students and judges, although they're a bit more obvious than the rest of us, we all have a special role to play in this profession insofar as law has a role to play in any government and for us within our Republican government. And I wouldn't have started this way except I just wanted to share with you my reaction to this week's news, because as I was writing about anti-federalists and populists and how they were different and the same, it was obvious as I kept checking BBC News that there are other aspects to self-government that I typically take for granted. For me, however, watching this really reinvigorated my commitment to my scholarship and to trying to understand and speak to others about the role of law in democratic government, because the news itself reminded me in a most visceral way that self-rule is a precious thing. So, with no more drama, on to the anti-federalists and their relationship with populism. Let me remind you briefly, I'm going to first of all try to talk a little bit about what populists and the anti-federalists might be seen to have in common, and then talk about whether or not there is enough crossover that we might think of the anti-federalists as a kind of proto-populist for this country. In a nutshell, my answer to the first question is yes. Both groups, although they are obviously full of lots of individual members with various perspectives, but both groups, by and large, favor a more direct form of democracy, right? They don't favor direct democracy in the sense that all citizens get together and vote directly on all laws, but they favor a more direct form of democracy than is put forth in the Constitution, or as in the populist case, at least how they see the Constitution being carried out today. They want a more direct role for the common citizen, at least for the middle class. And they harbor deep suspicions of elites, who they understand as both experts or maybe those who might be seen as having a better capacity to rule, right? It's not necessarily just about wealth, but it's about the claim that I know something special and am better at ruling. And they also are suspicious of complex institutions. And I think something that oftentimes gets overlooked in complex institutions is just the idea of complex laws. They embrace the idea that laws ought to be simple and understandable by everybody. And I'm sure at whatever stage you're in law school right now, you're beginning to see that simplicity might not be one of the advantages of our system. Nonetheless, I don't think that we can fairly call the Anti-Federalists a kind of proto-populists. Their advocacy for more direct government and the prominence of the will of the people was really premised on beliefs about the function of a political community's size that populism doesn't share. So at the end of the day, I suspect that the Anti-Federalists might actually be more critical of populism than they were of the Federalists themselves. And by the end of my talk, I hope I will have explained why. First of all, just a word on what I mean when I say populists are populisms. I'm really glad that somebody's going to discuss that in a little bit more depth than me, because I basically decided to take this term in the most general sense that I could. Not only because I'm not a scholar of populism, but because I thought that for today's purpose, the best thing to do was to try to sketch it in its most generalized ways so that we could talk about some of the aspects of it that are relevant to today's political movements, whether or not those are actually technically populism. And also populism, right? It doesn't just vary in this country over time. It varies around the globe, and I'm not going to get into that. So what's my extremely simplified version of populism? Well, it has two elements. Direct rule or more direct rule, but for the purposes of today, I'm going to call it direct rule by the people. Let me start with the simpler of those first. By the people, as in not experts, as in not elites. The two reasons why I believe populists criticize rule that isn't more directly by the people is because they see those who aren't the people themselves as both more corruptible, perhaps because they're more morally suspect, but also for a reason that is far more less contentious, perhaps, which is that they're not ruling in their own interests, right? Because they are not the people, how can they rule in the interests of the people? Then the more direct rule, the more direct prong of the populism test that I've devised for today. I think we all know that our national government is designed, in a sense, to check the will of the people, because sometimes 51% of the people can be either incredibly imprudent or, horrifically unjust. The complexity of our government structure maintains the will of the people as the ultimate source of government authority. I realize that's quite a claim, but we're just going to go with that for today. While moderating that will through institutions that delay, that require negotiation among factions, and also that bolster the rule of law. By contrast, populism doesn't brook delay, moderation of the people's will, nor sometimes even the rule of law. The emphasis is on pulling down or weeding out corruption and getting things done quickly. So instead, you might say that populism's methods employ simplification, speed, and if need be, at least arguably superseding the Constitution and legal barriers to government action. So do the Anti-Federalists agree with this platform? More direct rule by the people? I think they do, at least by and large. Their fears and warnings about the Constitution include warnings of elite rule, whether that be wealth or expert or claims to superiority in capacity to rule, warnings of corrupt rule, which they associate with both elite and complex government, and an insistence upon the fact that the government must follow the will of the majority, the will of that 51%, which they think requires clear lines of division between the major branches of the government and short terms. Clear lines of division between the separate branches of the government, because you need to know who is responsible for a government action, and short terms, so that once you understand who is responsible for something that is not the will of the people, you can get those folks out of office, a short leash republic. The Anti-Federalists have quite a bit in common with the populists, and they do want more direct rule by the people. But this, I believe, does not indicate that they are some kind of proto-populist. And I'm going to spend the rest of my time trying to articulate why. The anti-federalist insistence on a simple government dominated by the will of the people is premised on an understanding of local or regional, I'm going to call it small, government a lot of today, but that I don't necessarily mean that your government isn't doing a lot. What I mean is that the size of the territory and or the number of people you are governing over is a smaller group of people. So that's what I mean by small government at this point, or small nation. So their theories are premised on the earlier premise that you must have a small nation. This is why they so vehemently respond not only to the form of the Constitution, but to the fact of a national constitution. And at the end of the day, if they have to accept the fact of a national constitution, yes, they want to debate that form. But they're actually also just objecting to becoming one national government. And I don't think we can understand their critique of the form without understanding their critique of the fact or the size of the nation. All right, so why do they have this issue about the size of the government? To try to give this to you, I want you to let you know that Brutus 1 through 4 is probably the best place to go to for an encapsulation of what I'm going to summarize for you today. So that would be your quickest place if you're really interested in this idea of a small republic to get brushed up on it. But you can also find most or all of this in Sentinel, Federal Farmer, Agrippa, Melancton Smith, maybe not all in one place, but I am generalizing, but Brutus is your place to go if you want it quick. If you don't, then just dive in. There's lots of it. All right, three main reasons. The anti-federalists thought a free government must be a government where people assent to the rule. That was their definition of free government. A free government is a government where people assent to the rule. And they fundamentally thought this was impossible over a large population spread out over a large piece of land because, as they said, you will simply have too many interests. You might think of this as too many types of people, but I think that that tends to run into ideas that they're not necessarily talking about that we focus on a lot today. They're partially talking about the fact that you have different industries and you have different geographic needs and you have a different history to deal with if you are in Alaska than if you are in Virginia, than if you are in Manhattan, than if you are in Houston, that if you are in, for crying out loud, even the Keys versus Jacksonville, Florida, right? There's, if you think about it, if you're trying to write laws for that broad a set of interests, that many different interests, your laws are automatically going to be more complex because they're trying to cover more different scenarios. So what they said was you can't get assent. You cannot get free government. You cannot get assent from the people over that broad a set of different interests. So it's impossible to have a free government that is a large government if we define free government as government by assent of the people. They said a large nation is going to be one of two things. It's going to be a giant homogenization machine, or it's going to be despotic and rule by force. Has to be one of those two things. And I leave it to you to think about how those two factors may have been at work over the course of American history. But a small nation is necessary because then you have less interests. Now, when you have less total interest in the country, they say, you can have something that I would call, and I think other people have called this before, so I'm not taking credit for, a mirror legislature. What a mirror legislature means is you have a legislature that actually looks like the people. In large part, the Federalists wanted a legislature that was better than the people. Not necessarily morally better, but more competent at least. You know, like you pick a basketball team from across the country, you get a better basketball team than if you pick it out of one state. Most of the time, anyway. The anti-federalists reject this. They want a team of average basketball players. And they want to represent all of the different types of basketball players. They want all of the trades represented, all of the different kinds of professions, at least down to kind of what we would define as lower middle class. They want those people in the legislatures for a variety of reasons. If you think about their definition of a free government, it kind of matches with that. But also, a legislature that has a more thorough knowledge of the people is going to be able to write laws better adapted to it. It is going to have warmer feelings towards that people, those people. We have less desire to oppress the people living in the house next to us usually than the people across the country. And there's just the kind of the self-interest aspect of it. Okay, so we have a small republic has less total interests, therefore it can create this mirror legislature, and the mirror legislature they thought was really crucial to short-term limits and simple government working. Because if you have that mirror legislature, then that extremely, in a sense, volatile small legislature, if it has short-term limits and it has simple government, is also, it is the people. It's not going to oppress the people because it is the people. That was really the bottom line of their idea. All right, finally, and I think this is one of the more overlooked, but the more possibly important, definitely more interesting to me ideas. The anti-federalists argue that nation size makes a difference with national virtue. So, populists tend to have a rhetoric that says elite bad, ordinary person good, as if there's a moral difference between an elite and an everyday person. And you can find that rhetoric in the anti-federalists. But I think their more profound point, and a point that they do make over and over again, is that there is something corrupting about power itself. And so they fundamentally wanted a smaller nation, a less powerful nation, so that it would have less power, so that it would be less corrupted by that power. In other words, they think that a large nation is going to really fan ambition and love of glory in the human heart. If you create a great nation, they argue, great leaders will come forward. You will create a culture in which people are praised for and aspire to power. The quality of the leaders and the quality of the people they lead will be less because of that of the presidency. The human heart craves glory, and this is not a love that should be tempted, they think. So I think that this might be something that is really a foreign idea to the populace, at least of today, that heading to DC to clean out the government might have some later effects that they don't see. The danger is that in taking back the nation, they clear the way for a power-loving tyrants that a large nation has created. History teaches, and the anti-federalists well knew, that after a mob takes over, a tyrant steps forward to rule that mass movement. In other words, populists step down to tear down the rights-protecting devices necessary for a large nation, those put in place by our friends the Federalists, to simplify the government and make it more responsive to the people. And in the imagination of the anti-federalists, then a tyrant raised on the glory-loving culture of a large nation steps forward to direct and dominate the people who have cleared the path for him. A large nation is not just dangerous because of the difficulty of governing well, they would argue. It is dangerous because insofar as it is governed well, it creates an enormous temptation to power in a culture that loves power. And I think the Federalists would say the populace might just clear the way for the next Caesar. Thank you.
I regard my place in this discussion as to assume in some ways the posture of a historian, but rather than, say, a political theorist. But I think that the general question that is before us has to do with whether ideas are capable of crossing the boundaries of time and being replicated in successive generations without fundamental changes in their content. The methodology of originalism and constitutional interpretation privileges history, and I think for two reasons. First, because it's assumed that if you take the ideas and language of a founding generation and privilege those in interpreting the provisions that that generation enacts, then you're guarding against the tendency of moderns to reinterpret the meaning of language. So when you, particularly when you have open-ended language in a constitution, there may be a concern that current generations will distort it for their own political or ideological purposes. So by privileging the original understanding of constitutional provisions, you're trying to safeguard against that. Perhaps the more weighty assumption that originalists make is that some ideas in a founding period are just plain good ideas that deserve to be preserved, that their insights about governance or politics that this particular generation has hit upon and reflected in constitutional provisions, and successive generations should respect those. So the question then, I think, if one is an originalist or is operating in a world in which originalism is taken to be a weighty interpretive methodology, then current generations are constantly put in the posture of looking back at a past enactment, a past provision, and asking themselves, why should we follow it? Why should we respect it? Now, the problem that creates is not so much that the methodology itself is incoherent. Some historians believe originalism to be incoherent because they believe it's incapable to fully recover the record of the past sufficiently to understand what past actors were thinking or feeling. But I'm putting those criticisms aside and assuming that originalism has some kind of interpretive coherence. But it is a methodology that requires contemporary actors constantly to revisit and reinterpret the past. And here I think that there's an endemic difficulty that surfaces. The difficulty is that of anachronism. When one is a contemporary actor, one has experiences in the world surrounding one, and those experiences shape one's attitudes, whether or not one is wanting the attitudes to be shaped. It's just an experience that isn't precisely the experience that was past generations. So you can't fully put yourself back into the shoes of historical actors. You may try as a historian to recover their attitudes and experiences as accurately as you can, but you can't fully understand where they're coming from. So there is a dissonance then anytime one seeks to interpret the past, whether it's language in the past or attitudes in the past or events in the past. There is a danger of the interpretation being colored by the perspectives and attitudes of the present interpreter. And anachronism emerges when a present actor projects contemporary attitudes on the past and equates language or attitudes or events in the past consistent with the experiences that they have in the present. That is, the present actor tends to think that a political party or a political ideology is comparable to one in their own world. And the danger that creates is that it may trigger an effort to make that ideology over into one that is cognizable in one's own world. And that I think is a serious problem with using the label populism as an attitude that's capable of crossing generations. So let me just bring a little bit of history into the analysis. Of course, the anti-federalists didn't use the term populism. They weren't described as populists. The term populism was not in the political vocabulary of Americans until the late 19th century. And when it emerged in a specific historical context. The context was the effect of industrialism and urbanization on agrarian interests, particularly the interests of farmers and local merchants who were in the process of shipping produce to markets outside their local communities. And the principal mechanism in which they were shipping produce was the railroad. The late 19th century has a tremendous growth in the railroad industry and the emergence of transcontinental railroad lines, the invention of compatible track surfaces so that you could have very long-term rail lines that you didn't have to change the track from one to another if you crossed a state line or if another railroad was involved. You get railroad mergers. And it turns out that as industrial life develops in American cities, many of the late 19th century industries have close connections with the railroads because it's the railroads that they're using to ship their products. It's the railroads they're using to distribute what they manufacture. And a somewhat cozy relationship emerges between large-scale industrial enterprises and railroad lines so that the rate system by which merchandise is shipped varies considerably depending on who's shipping it. And in short, farmers in the Midwest and small merchants in the Midwest think that they're getting disadvantaged in the process, and they're unable to control this because of the consolidation of industry and of railroad lines. So in their view, these are business elites, if you will, adversely affecting them. And they feel politically disadvantaged to respond to this process because they think that the government structure, the Congress and state officials are also controlled by or at least favorably disposed toward larger interests. So they begin a movement designed to strip the power of these elites. The antitrust movement comes out of populism. The idea of regulating railroads significantly, breaking up mergers, all of those are programs initiated by the populace. The populace have a party. The populist party, and in the 1890s, the populist party becomes a kind of what you might want to call a progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and some candidates run as independent populist candidates, distinguishing themselves from Democrats, and so the populists become a relatively important force in late 19th century American politics, and to some extent they are precursors of the progressives, so that some historians think that there's a kind of line of liberal or progressive politics that starts with the populists and goes through the progressives to the New Deal and beyond. My point here is that populism has a specific historical meaning and a specific historical time. Now, can one say that the anti-federalists are anything like that? Well, in the first place, they inhabit a very different world of political economy. There's no massive industrialization in the framing period. There's not a lot of urbanization. There's a very small federal government. There's some active regulatory activity at the state government level, the regulation of transportation franchises, for example. But most Americans are living in a rural environment. They're living on farms or plantations, and the issues that are paramount in the framing generation are not issues of consolidated, urbanized, or industrialized power. They just aren't. Now, that's not to say that the anti-federalists and the populists share a kind of suspicion of elites. They do. But what do we mean? But what we mean by elite seems to me qualitatively different. So I don't think that much is to be gained, at least from the point of view of historical accuracy, by calling the anti-federalists populists. I mean, I think there are many labels one could use for anti-federalists that better capture their posture in their generation. Now, pressing forward, if there are difficulties in trying to apply a label identifying a particular political party or ideology in one time to another, might there not be similar difficulties in bringing the label forward into our world, again, a world that's dramatically different from the late 19th century? Is it helpful to think of American politicians who profess a disdain for elites and interest in cleansing elite corruption, an interest in somehow restoring government to the people? Is it useful to identify such persons as populists? Well, like so many labels from American politics, these labels emerge from a kind of lazy, reflexive thinking on the part of journalists and pundits. I mean, you've got to call these people something. You know, you have to call Donald Trump something. Maybe Donald Trump is a populist, or maybe X or Y is a populist. Well, when you say that, what are you clarifying? How are you helping things? Aren't you inviting the same kinds of anachronistic readings of history that I've suggested emerge when you try to apply late 19th century label to a group of people in the founding generation? So, now, I don't want to suggest that ideas generated in one point in time are utterly incapable of being carried over into another. I mean, I don't think, for example, that the framers believed in democracy in the sense that we believe in. But the framers did believe in a degree of representative government, and that's an idea that's carried over. It's been reformulated. Our view of democracy is certainly not that of the framers. So I'm not suggesting that there are no ideas worth recovering and repeating, but I am suggesting that there is no bright line, there's no linear concordance between ideas in one era and another, and that it is a conceptual and analytical mistake to try to assume there is. Thank you.
Such an honor to be with you. It's been so long since I've seen you. So whether or not the anti-federalists were, as has been said, men of little faith, from a certain point of view, they were men of limited vision on some of the most important issues of the day. But on other issues, they were farsighted indeed. So fundamentally, they deserve the label that the Federalists gave them, anti-Federalist. They fundamentally deserve that because they were anti. They were opposed to the Constitution. And if you think, as I do, the Constitution is a pretty good idea, then you have to understand that in the main, these folks were opposed to that good idea. Fine. But it's not just that they were opposed to this idea. It's that I don't think they really had a compelling alternative plan. Maybe they weren't. They were rebels. So were the Federalists. They rebelled against King George and Parliament. Whether they were, the anti-Federalists were rebels without a clue, I think that would be too harsh. But they were rebels without a coherent alternative plan. And you need to understand that. Or to the extent that they did offer something, it's what Professor Kuhnmiller has said. They wanted actually a small nation, a series of small nations. She said, you must have, and it's not describing them, their vision was, you must have a small nation. Small nation is necessary. Well, that would be nice if a small nation were possible, okay? And if you think a small nation is possible, why don't you actually ask today a Latvian or a Lithuanian or an Estonian, or actually pay attention to what's happening in the world today? Because the problem with small nations is they get gobbled up because it's a nasty, brutish world. And this is what George Washington understands, because he actually first fought the French in the French and Indian War, and then fought the British. And he and the Federalists understand viscerally that if America does not, if these colonies do not actually unite and indivisibly so, and to create a continental force structure that will actually have a huge oceanic moat protecting us from the old powers of Europe, their monarchs and militaries, we're going to all be speaking Russian, or maybe Spanish, or maybe French, or maybe English, but it'll be the Queen's English, as in the Crown, or the King's English, as in George III, and they don't want that. So small nation might be all very well and good if you lived in some alternative universe. So that's what the anti-federalists, frankly, didn't quite get, to the extent that they were just opposed to the Constitution, but they actually did have. That's where I think they were persons of limited vision, but they also were farsighted, and they contributed to. And that's why, at the end of the day, I'm with George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and John Marshall and the so-called Federalists. But the anti-Federalists did have I thought that, okay, this plan that's been proposed has some major defects, and maybe it can be improved upon. And yesterday I told you about this epic conversation that occurred about the ratification of the document. Will we? Won't we? We do, we don't. And in that conversation, up and down the continent, it's not just that they're voting on the thing, it's that they're talking about the thing. And in the course of talking about the thing, the critics actually articulate, the anti-federalists, lots of ideas, some of which are good ones. And the Federalists, to their credit, listen, pivot, and actually compromise, reach out. And we call that, for example, among other things, the Bill of Rights, which is an anti-federalist-inspired idea and a good one. So my friend John McGinnis was absolutely right yesterday when we were up here, when I got a little carried away and I told you, you know, pay no attention to that Thomas Jefferson figure. I just wanted to say something like that because I'm here at Charlottesville, of course. Get your juices going. But of course, without Thomas Jefferson, who was resolute in an anti-federalist spirit, that there must be a Bill of Rights, maybe we wouldn't have had that. And so we have them to thank for initiating the idea, and the Federalists we have to thank for listening to that. Okay, America is deeply, deeply divided. Almost half the people vote no, and yet, actually, the two camps come together, and we call that the Bill of Rights. Wow. And that emerges from this ratification process, which is a we the people process, quite literally. Okay, so here are the two big ideas. First, Congress is too small to be genuinely representative. It just won't look like America. And Professor Kuhnmiller talked about the idea of a legislative mirror, the idea that the legislature, your representative body, should be, in a word, well, representative. And just to, so you can see the point, there are going to be 65 members of the original House of Representatives. Now, they're going to be direct elected, unlike Articles of Confederation. That's progress. But they're going to be able to impose direct taxes on individuals, which the Congress and the Articles couldn't. And they're going to be 10 people from Virginia, whereas the Virginia legislature has close to 400, you see. 65 compared to 1,500 assemblymen up and down the continent. Okay, and it's worse than 65, you see, because if you actually read the document, and this is what Patrick Henry says in Virginia, leading anti-federalist, he says, actually, the document says you can't have more than a certain amount, but actually, in theory, you could have one representative from each state. You could have a House of Representatives of 13 people, smaller than the Senate, of which 7 would be a quorum, of which 4 would be a majority of the quorum, as to which the Federalists basically say, oops. Because actually read the document, it actually says that. And then they say, oh, you can't just take it literally. Oh, that was a mistake, okay. That was temporary, it was a stopgap. We don't have a census yet, so we just had to improvise, but we're gonna have a census really soon, and we promise it's gonna expand as fast as the document permits. And they're true to their word. And they even proposed an original amendment, the original First Amendment, that would have guaranteed fast congressional growth. It wasn't ratified, came close to being ratified. One state ratified the other amendments and not it. You can guess which one. It was Delaware, which wanted a small House of Representatives. If there were 13 people in the House, they would have had equality in both the House and the Senate. So it came close to be ratified, but it didn't need to, perhaps in the end, because Congress, the first Congresses, did it anyway. And after 3 censuses, you're up to 200 people, which, you know, is but better than 65. And that's an anti-federalist idea, that the representatives should look like the people, look more like the people than the original House, which went too far in trying to create an elite body of very impressive folk, but that lost, I think, too much of the mirror concept. And the compromise that emerges is, yes, it's going to be pretty elite and distinguished, but it will be more representative than the text actually originally envisioned. Now, the second big anti-federalist idea that wins. They have lots of ideas, and they're not very coherent. And some states, too hot, too cold, too big, too small. So you can't please them all. But there are other very emphatic thought is you need a Bill of Rights. And here they are channeling the American tradition because state constitutions have bills of rights. States are the template often for the federal discourse. Federal constitutions written, well, states have written constitutions. Bicameral legislatures, most states do, except for Pennsylvania and Georgia. Tripartite, most states, have that. Most states have bills of rights, you see, and the federal government and another oops. And it takes Madison a very long time to confess error on this. He's given the credit for being the father of the Bill of Rights or something. No, actually, it takes him a year to make the pivot, almost, in order to get elected in Virginia and to get the Constitution ratified. He has to sort of change his stripes on that. So don't give him total credit, and do give Jefferson credit, because Jefferson's pushing him from France on this. My apologies, Mr. Jefferson. I sold you short yesterday. The Bill of Rights that emerges, because the Federalists do pivot on that too, they say, if you will agree to let this thing be ratified, we will agree to work with you in the new regime to try to accommodate some of your concerns. Now, anti-federalists don't get the actual amendments they want. They want limits, for example, on the federal governments to impose direct taxes and other things on individuals. And they don't quite get major structural revisions. But they do get a Bill of Rights, what you call the first 10 amendments, that use the phrase, the people, in no fewer than 5 different amendments. And that is populist from a certain way, just in a certain perspective, etymologically. So the First Amendment right of the people to petition assembly, and the Second Amendment right of the people to keep and bear arms. Yes, a Yale law professor actually just mentioned that Second Amendment right, and the Fourth Amendment right of the people to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures, and the Ninth and Tenth Amendment rights reserved and retained by the people. The people, the people, the people, the people, the people. That's the phrase that appears in more of the Bill of Rights, more of the amendments than any other phrase. And it's coming from, kind of recapitulatingly, the preamble, a we the people process in which actually ordinary voters were asked, do you or don't you? Do you agree or not agree to a document that had been framed by elites behind closed doors in not altogether transparent way? And the people there actually has a kind of communal, collective meaning. William Douglas in Griswold versus Connecticut, he's trying to say, the right of the people to, the First Amendment has all, is about privacy or something. No, it's not about two persons assembling on a bed. That's not what it's actually about. It's about people en masse assembling and writing petitions to change government policy. You see, and the Second Amendment is ordinary people collectively an institution that's populist from a certain point of view. The rights reserved by the Ninth and Tenth Amendments are populist in various ways. So they're about people power, popular sovereignty power. And the Fourth Amendment actually has a populist angle too. As I'll explain in just 1 minute, if there's a single idea, borrow from my friend Professor White, or institution that's at the heart of the Bill of Rights, it's actually the jury. That's not what you would think today, but the jury is there. It's Fifth Amendment grand jury, Sixth Amendment trial jury, criminal, and Seventh Amendment civil jury, it's. You can see the jury in the Fifth Amendment Just Compensation Clause. Civil juries decide what's a fair price if the government takes your property. Civil juries are deciding what searches and seizures are reasonable or not under the Fourth Amendment. Second Amendment, your militia, they're basically jurors with guns in their hands. They're local, collective amateurs arrayed against elites, arrayed against professionals. So they're local populaces in a tradition that you heard Professor Con Miller sort of articulate, that it's more localist, and it does involve, here are some of her phrases. It's a more direct form of democracy. It involves common citizens. It reflects, juries do, suspicion of elites, short terms. You know, you rotate on or off, and actually people did multiple jury service over the course of their years. It's localist. We can't actually have 13 nation states. We have to have one indivisible union for all sorts of reasons. Now, we can have variation on all sorts of things where we don't need to have one national rule. And that's what the anti-federalists understand, and we call that federalism. And in order to hold together, because we are so diverse, I think we may have to decide there's some things where we're going to just have to allow lots of local option. Maybe, you know, abortion after the 15th week will be one of those things that we're going to actually have different rules about very shortly, precisely because it is such a large and diverse continent. We need national rules for continental defense after the 14th Amendment. We need some basic human rights and political rights that are uniform. But the key anti-federalist ideas of a bigger house and a Bill of Rights prevailed. And good for them, the key institution, which is not very robust today, alas, but that could be revived, is the jury. And one interesting question is whether this localist, populist institution can continue to serve its function after later constitutional amendments, like the Civil War amendments, that are much more nationalist in their vision and less localist. That's a question maybe for another day, or perhaps for the Q&A. Thank you very much.
So let me start by just asking, Professor Amar has had a chance to respond to some of the things that the two of you have said, but I invite any of the panelists, if there's any comment that you want to provide on any other panelists' remarks before I go into my questions, I open the floor to you. All right, let me just jump in with my questions. Professor Amar, since you invited the question, how did the later 14th Amendment change this original Bill of Rights vision?
So America's Constitution is, to a very great extent, a product of our history. Our history is very much shaped by wars, in particular constitutional wars. The Revolutionary War is a constitutional war. The Civil War is a constitutional war, but with very different visions. So the Revolutionary War is a ragtag bag, a band of local rebels against an imperial center that's seen as corrupt. It's Luke Skywalker and Han Solo against an evil empire. So Star Wars is very much an American revolutionary kind of story. Now, see, that's not the Civil War. In the Civil War, it's actually the states that are misbehaving, including this one, because of a local institution, slavery, that is utterly tyrannical. And the heroes of that saga are going to be, so the Revolutionary War is going to celebrate local militias. It's going to lead to a Second Amendment. But Civil War, actually, it's the Boys in Blue. It's Grant's army. It's the national force structure that now represents every man. That's Tom Hanks in Saving Private Ryan or something. It's not a local militia. It's the national army that's going to defeat Hitler. So the founders very much believed in a right of local juries are power centers of a certain sort. And local juries and local assemblies were at the heart of the American Revolution. The framers of the 14th Amendment recast all of that. Just as they took the militia idea at the heart of the Second Amendment and privatized it, made it more about a right of individuals to have guns in their homes, They took a jury idea that was in large part a right to participate and turned it more into a civil rights idea, a right to be tried by a jury. The 15th Amendment is going to come along and say, oh, black people have a right to participate in juries. And the 19th Amendment, women have a right to participate in juries. But there's going to be a tension between a series of amendments. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no laws. It's limiting the national government. And the Reconstruction Amendments all end with Congress shall power, Congress shall power, Congress shall power, 13th Amendment Section 2, 14th Amendment Section 5, 15th Amendment Section 2. So that's the deep intergenerational tension you see. And Professor White says, oh, this is very complicated, taking ideas from different peers. First of all, getting them right, each one on its own bottom, and then trying to actually somehow fit them together. Wow, that's complicated stuff, and he's right.
Thank you. Professor White, does populism, the label populism for a contemporary political label, does that have any usefulness?
Well, my earlier remarks suggested probably not. In a sense, you need some kind of term to capture attitudes that favor participatory democracy, a government in which the principal decision maker is the people at large, and to the extent that contemporary political actors are saying, I want more of that and less government by elites of one fashion or another. That is to say, representative of officials, elected officials, ostensibly representing their constituency, sees ought to be consistently mindful of adhering to what the people at large think. I think on the political spectrum there are political actors who favor something like that approach, so that describe themselves as favoring, let's say, participatory democracy or having a lot of referendums on issues, involving the people directly in government as fully as possible. I don't like populism as a label to represent that point of view. But if that's what everyone would agree, or if that's what would generally be understood as populism meant, then I think that is a force in contemporary politics. But I want to say, just in general, I am deeply suspicious of political labels. I'm deeply suspicious of the labels liberal and conservative as applied to Supreme Court justices. I don't like the label progressive as applied to certain contemporary politicians. And the reason is I don't think people understand what those words mean. Again, it gets back to what I said earlier. I just think they invite, I mean, saying, for example, that the current the prospective nomination to the Supreme Court, it isn't going to change the conservative liberal demarcation of the court. I mean, that just presupposes that everybody on the court is some kind of monolith that takes predictable positions on issues. And I just don't think that captures things well, and it invites kind of lazy thinking. I've been inveighing against the use of labels for much of my career. I notice it hasn't had very much effect on
Thank you. Professor Kuhn-Miller, what do you think that the anti-federalists would prescribe today if they were to sit down and talk with the so-called populists?
So I think I kind of walked just up to it, but I didn't really emphasize it at the end of my talk, which is that I think they might say, okay, but you have a large government. You have a large nation. Yeah, they might take a look at Europe and say, wow, in hindsight, we were wrong on that point. And the thing that I the reason why I say that I think that the anti-federalists might actually be more critical of populist movements in a large nation than they were of the federalists themselves is because they were not unreasonable men. And I do wonder if they might be able to see that, for example, short terms and of simplified government and simplification of the separation between the branches and more accountability. Basically, everything that our federal constitution does to check that 51%, that if you have a large country and you cleanse it of those checking mechanisms and those mechanisms to try to bring some prudence to the process, that what you might end up with is a government with the worst evils of both a large government and a small government. And I think, yeah, in my then fantasy version of that conversation, they either roll up their sleeves and start to really talk about to each other about, okay, so is free government really possible, right? Are we so large that we must be despotic? Or are we so small that we must be conquered? Which is really how Hamilton starts the Federalist Papers, is by saying, you love your liberty so much that you are going to be so jealous of giving any of it away that you will lose all of it, right? So I think that at that point, they might hear that. They might hope the Federalists could hear them. And they might try to warn the populace that you can't have the worst of both worlds. So,
thank you. All right, I am getting ready to turn it over to the audience for questions. I have never been disappointed in a Federalist Society audience, and I know I'm going to be able to count on my friend Mike at some point. He is always a person who asks a question, but I will start with students. Gentleman back there, in the bow tie. With the glasses, yes.
I've got two questions. One for Professor White. How do you understand looking over the course of history and how there's different political movements at different times, if we're not gonna call today's worldwide emphasis on popular leadership and ideas over the elites, with things we see with like Sanders, Trump, and Johnson in the UK. How do we phrase it today? If we don't tie modern movements back to like more historical ideas, how do we phrase these? How do we refer to these more modern political ideas? And for Professor Amar, what would the anti-federalists have thought of jury nullification? I know the jury was really important to them. What would their thoughts have been on that? Thank you.
Why don't we take them in order, Professor White?
Yeah, with respect to figures like Boris Johnson, I think it's the label populist for Johnson is really sort of ironic. At that point, the label has almost become, you're a populist if you're a critic of the established governmental order. And you can be a critic of the established governmental order from a variety of points of view. I don't think you necessarily have to be a populist. If one wanted to be snarky, one might say that a populist is someone who is a critic of the established governmental order who has tendencies to be a tyrant.
The anti-federalists believed in what we would call today, some people call jury nullification. I think a more technical or precise formulation would be acquittals against the evidence. This is in the criminal domain. It remains the case even today that every criminal jury in America has, I would say, the right, not just the power, although lawyers aren't allowed to argue this, to acquit against the evidence. Why do I say that's a right? Because no judge in America, federal judge, can direct an order of conviction. Because once an acquittal has occurred, that's done. It can never be undone by JNOV. And even if it's inconsistent with another kind of jury verdict, you're accused of having done A and B, and either you did both or you did neither, because your claim is mistaken identity, and the jury convicts you of A but not of B. They split the difference. It's inconsistent verdicts, but that can't be the basis to set aside a verdict. So there is a right today of juries to acquit against the evidence. There are organizations that try to talk about this, the Fully Informed Jury Association, a very interesting kind of motley band of tax evaders and drug users. It's kind of, you know, right-wing libertarians meet left-wing libertarians. It's a very interesting group. They've sometimes identified me as their patron saint, because I believe in juries. And I also believe in a thing called jury review, which is a little different than jury nullification, but it's the right and duty, maybe, of juries to decide constitutional questions, just as judges do. There's a bicameral judiciary, you see, with the Article III judges being kind of like the Senate, and a jury kind of being like the lower house of a bicameral judiciary. And the executive branch in the criminal domain has a president or an executive, AG, U.S. District Attorney, and a grand jury, which can simply refuse to indict, and that's that. If a grand jury just refuses to indict for, let's say, federal drug crimes in Colorado, there's nothing that Jeff Sessions can do about that, which is why Jeff Sessions did not bring federal drug prosecutions in Colorado. So jury nullification, jury review, in certain forms, especially on the criminal side, still have certain residues, and they're very much anti-federalist residues.
Gentlemen.
Professor White, you mentioned the origins of populism in the late 19th century and the railroad. And whatever we would call today with the advent of President Trump, whether it's populism or not, there's still this kind of anti-corporate flair. And my question is as it relates to not just political ideology, but also to economics, what would the anti-federalists have thought about the corporate form in laissez-faire capitalistic economics in general?
Yeah, Important words for the founding generation are virtue and corruption. And the anti-federalists are suspicious of, I mean, the assumption in the framing generation is that if you get into government, being a human, you're going to necessarily start preferring your own interests. There are going to be incentives and tendencies for you to favor your interests at the expense of others. That's why factions develop. And in some respects, the anti-federalists are even more committed to the concept of virtue and anti-corruption than the Federalists, but these are very charged and important concepts for the framing generation. So you can see, in a sense, these being replicated in the populace of the late 19th century. Now, once again, there's corruption going on because industrial elites and railroads are conspiring to affect the capacity of more marginal actors in the economy. So, and that, of course, you know, that is a very long-standing tradition in American politics, this sort of suspicion of the motives of governing elites and corporate elites. I mean, consider I noticed that two labels have emerged sort of in the last decade. big pharma and big tech. And those labels are not merely descriptive. You know, those labels are pejorative. The idea is that you can't trust size in the economy. You can't trust the motives. You know, the pharmaceutical companies are pretending to help us, but they're actually mainly concerned with making money. Technology is claiming to be spokespeople for free speech, but all they're really concerned is their advertising revenues, et cetera. So yes, I take your point.
Stephen?
This question is probably best for Professor Amar. You've talked a little bit about how history can better shape our understanding, and obviously Thomas Jefferson, being such an established anti-federalist, still presided over the Louisiana Purchase, and James Monroe, another anti-federalist, was the lead negotiator on that. How do you reconcile the two of those, and how can the debates that followed that purchase in Congress and around the nation help us better understand the original understanding of the Constitution?
Oh, thanks so much for that question, which gives me a chance to plug the new book, which I haven't done in the last 30 seconds. So I discussed that set of issues in great detail in this new book, The Words That Made Us. And what I say, and I'm not the first to say it, Henry Adams said it a long time ago, is basically Jefferson as president governs as a Hamiltonian. And I say because actually Hamilton was right on certain things, and Jefferson came to understand that. I phrase it in a kind of provocative way. I say Jefferson was a very interesting character. He had, you know, certain flaws, but happily the flaws beautifully offset sometimes. He believed a lot of silly things initially, but thankfully he was a hypocrite. So when he came to power, he actually abandoned some of the silly things that he had said when other people had power. So he says, for example, we need a constitutional amendment to do the Louisiana Purchase. And then when it turns out, oh, a constitutional amendment is actually rather inconvenient, you know, for him. He says, oh, well, let's, you know, just do it without a constitutional amendment, which is what Hamilton said. And Hamilton was right to begin with. So they opposed the bank. But then who signs the bank bill into law? That would be James Madison with Thomas Jefferson's endorsement, you see. So... so that's why I'm with and you want, I want you to read McCulloch versus Maryland, because here's what John Marshall says again and again. He says, first of all, it's a unanimous decision, and 5 of the 7 justices in McCulloch were appointed by Madison and Jefferson. You see, so that's one thing. It's unanimous, and by this point, Madison himself supports the bank, you know, or and the Louisiana Purchase and all these other things. And Marshall, on several occasions, at least 2 in McCulloch, actually points out that that Madison and Jefferson have flip-flopped on this issue, because he's saying, we, that is George Washington, a mind as, this is his quote, a mind as pure as intelligent as this country can boast, and Hamilton, whom he reveres, and I, John Marshall, were right all along. And they don't want to admit it, so they say it very kind of quietly. But they've become Hamiltonians because we were right about what the country needs and what the Constitution says.
The woman with the mask under her chin. Sorry, didn't mean to call you out on that.
At least you got one.
Thank you so much. This question is, I guess, primarily for Professor White. But I was wondering, you kind of jumped from the framing to the 1890s when you discussed populist. And for me, the first person I think of with populism is Jackson. And I was very curious how Jackson fits into the narrative, both with the anti-federalist and then with the later populist, and if maybe when we use the term populist today, we're thinking more of a Jacksonian figure and less of the progressives of the early 20th century.
Yeah, he's a populist. Jackson is a populist in the sense of campaigning against elites, and also making some moves cultural moves early in his administration that could be understood as identifying himself directly as a man of the people. One thing he does, and it turns out to be fairly disastrous, is he opens the White House to just anyone who wants to visit on a social occasion, and so a bunch of people just walk in, and then it creates a kind of a chaotic situation, and they have to figure out what to do about it. But of course, Jackson himself, although he, again, rhetorically describes himself as an architect of state power, or suspicious of federal power and consolidation, he's not at all averse to expanding the power of the national government when it suits his purposes. You know, if one wants to identify populism with a kind of appeal to ordinary folks, maybe even championing their attitudes and values, then Jackson fits rather well into that.
And I know the question wasn't directed at me, but just to connect it to what Professor Kunmiller sort of reminded us of, which is, you know, the importance of the local. Jackson is a really interesting synthesis. It's not a surprise that a constitution that then quickly leads to a sort of a Bill of Rights synthesis generates a regime in which the dominant figure in antebellum America after the founders have passed from the scene is Andrew Jackson. It's the age of Jackson, basically post-Jefferson and pre-Lincoln. And that's because, you see, he understands the national security imperative. He kicks the British ass in a way that George Washington could only have dreamed of doing. In the Battle of New Orleans, 3,000 Brits are killed or wounded, including the brother-in-law killed of the Duke of Wellington. 200 Americans die, and the French aren't there helping us out. In Yorktown, by contrast, there are two French warriors on land and sea for every American. Okay, so he can stand up against these European thugs, you know, who think they're and aristocrats who look down their noses on ordinary Americans. So that's the national security geostrategic thing. And he is absolutely fierce on indivisibility, as am I, as was George Washington and Alexander Hamilton. And Lincoln will stand on Jackson's shoulders. And he, you know, takes John C. Calhoun to task very much when Calhoun, and part of the problem with Jefferson is Jefferson has an inner, you know, secessionist to him, which is a problem because he missed the consolidating moment. But Jackson is absolutely fierce when it comes to Calhoun. So he's a nationalist, and he's really strong. At the end of his life, he was asked if he had if he'd left anything undone, and he said, "I didn't hang John C. Calhoun, and I didn't shoot Henry Clay." So don't mess with him. But he's very much on all sorts of things a champion of states' rights in a Jeffersonian tradition. So he's both, and he's an interesting synthesis that way. When it comes to the Indians and European nations, he's a super nationalist. When it comes to all sorts of other things, he leaves it to local option. And he's an interesting synthesis that way, but very much himself, he would describe himself as a Jeffersonian, small government, localist kind of guy, but it's complicated. Interesting synthesis of Federalist and Anti-Federalist.
Mike.
Well, this is pretty much for everyone. I'm curious, although I would like to say to the ever-entertaining Professor Amar, and take leave on some metaphors that I'm going to pass on here, because I think populists aren't necessarily gun-toting all the time, are they? But it, not that there's anything wrong with that. So my metaphor would be sort of much of War of the Worlds here. What do you think the Federalists and Anti-Federalists would disagree or agree if they were here in the 21st century seeing sort of a War of the Worlds eruption of administrative state that started with Wilson, and today we have executive orders, agencies with huge Leviathan-type power where due process is takes decades and years to get to, and juries that you're really have a lot of financial and judicial pressure not to get in front of. So settlements are off the charts. Juries are inexperienced, trial lawyers don't exist, and everything's about money and not justice. Do you think the Federalists and Anti-Federalists would just be shocked?
Who wants to take that one first?
Professor Connell hasn't had a chance yet to.
So here's the question. Did the Federalists see all of this coming, but think, yeah, there's going to be downsides, but what else can we do? And so, right? If that's the case, then they would say yes, but it's still better than being conquered. Like, our systems will only hold for so long. No, they're not perfectly imbalanced. No system can run without a good mechanic, and heaven knows if and when we will have good mechanics. So I honestly don't know the extent to which they understood the flaws of their system and figured, heck, it's still going to hold together better than anything else. I think the anti-federalists, these kinds of things that you're mentioning are in line with the kinds of predictions they were making about the growth of power, the corruption of power, the capacity for things to happen behind closed doors, the difficulty of holding a large national government accountable. So I think they would absolutely say, yeah, we told you so.
I think they would not be shocked because of their view of human nature. And I might point out that they also had a view of history. They don't think of history as progressives do, qualitative improvement over time, with each generation getting better than the previous one. They think of history as cyclical. They think of the course of nations is comparable to the course of humans. That is, you're born, you're a new nation, you come to maturity, and then you decay. And they fully expect the very republic that they're creating to disintegrate over time. So, and to disintegrate in part because of the incapacity of humans to transcend their poorer selves, their passions, their interests, their tendencies toward tyranny and corruption.
Remember, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists do agree in the end on a Bill of Rights that have juries really at the heart: Fifth Amendment grand jury, Sixth Amendment trial jury, criminal trial jury, Seventh Amendment civil jury, with jury analogs or counterparts in some of the other amendments. So. And we've lost that, and there are reasons I think we've lost that. Hamilton was not as celebratory of the jury as was Jefferson. Jefferson had a romantic vision of the jury. I'm with Jefferson on that. Hamilton, the Federalist, I think it's maybe 82, 83, says, you know, we all agree on jury trial, but some of us gush that it's, you know, the very apotheosis of everything, and others of us think it's just a pretty good anti-corruption device because you don't know who the jurors are going to be in advance. And so you can't, you know, bribe them in advance, and then they return to their communities, a civil society. So Hamilton does say, oh, at the end of the day, I think quoting I think maybe Pope, the government will be best that's best administered, and if the federal government is actually just well administered by experts, people will cotton to it. If you look at Hamilton, was a little bit, I think, cynical, more cynical than the average Federalist on that. So why have juries decayed? Part of it is, see, ordinary people don't want to serve because it's a hassle. And amateur organizations are going to lose out to professionals, and that's militias to armies, that's grand jurors to prosecutors, that's petit jurors to judges. They don't convene themselves. They actually require, you know, the kindness of judges to actually get them going, each jury. And over the long haul, yeah, the professional prosecutors and the professional judges, you know, they get paid to do this. This is what they do every day. The professional soldiers have real advantages over the amateur ordinary citizen. taking turns in in a way that I think Professor Kahn-Miller sort of very nicely gave us, you know, the image of what the anti-federalist vision was. Ordinary citizens taking turns.
Could I respond to Professor White for just a moment?
Sure. I agree with you about the tone of the age in terms of the cyclical idea of the lifespan of a nation. But Hamilton at times really seems to say, like, we've had advances in the science of politics, and because of these new advances, it kind of reminds me of when they come up with a new running shoe, right? And it's fabulous, but then we all tear out our knees because the shoe lets us do something with our ankles that we're not designed to do, right? So you beef up one area and then you put pressure somewhere else. And so, right, the Federalists think that they have advances in the science of politics, and I don't think that many people want to argue with them over whether or not they were right about that. But the question, one of the questions, I think, is whether or not the anti-Federalists were right to say, yeah, human nature, we agree with you, Federalists, is corruptible. But the problem is that you are going to create a nation which is going to create a kind of people that can't even run your system, right? So that's where I was talking about love of ambition and love of glory before, because by creating the large nation, you're going to create people that in this system that is designed to pit ambition against ambition, right? There's a reason why most of you have dreams of heading off to DC instead of Richmond. There is. And I'm not kidding, that's exactly what it is. Like, those of you who head off to the right jobs in DC have a level of prestige that those of you who head off to the right jobs in Richmond don't. That's the phenomenon they're talking about. And that is going to create a people who can't even run this system. And so it's something that, you know, maybe it takes 200 years, maybe it takes 400 years to develop, and it's impossible to measure. Right? So we're just talking about a theory here. But I think that is a big part of the anti-federalist critique, is that you're setting something in motion that is going to give human nature even a bigger temptation than what we already see at work.
Right there. Yes.
This question is primarily for Professor Kahn-Miller, but other panelists are welcome to answer as well. You mentioned the anti-federalist fear that we would either have a homogenization machine or despotic government. Where do you think the anti-federalists would see us in greater danger of one of those possibilities if they could see us today? Which one do you think they would say you're at greater risk of?
So I want to preface the answer to this question with politics is the art of the possible. And so I don't have a better suggestion to make, but both, right? Clearly, we fought a war, probably justifiably so, to end some of our despotism, but they're right, we had to use force. And we do coerce things that probably don't make sense in some parts of the country because they make sense in other parts of the country. But I mean, we can all see the forces of homogenization that are work if only through the market, so both. But again, it's not necessarily me saying our system is so bad. It's saying this is a clear downside.
You on the aisle, I would say in the pink tie, but I see a lot of pink ties, so.
Thank you for being here. Several of you mentioned that, I think Professor Amar, you said that the initial Congress was like 65 people, and today we have 435. So I did a little bit of math while I was sitting here and determined that, you know, if we kept the original ratio of Congress people to citizens, we'd have something like 5,000 people in Congress today. So first of all, is that a good idea? And second of all, would it allow for more, say, philosophical diversity? Because today, you know, the establishments of the political parties, you know, we have a party of the broad center left and a party of the broad center right, and figures like Bernie Sanders or Ron Paul only come around every once in a while. Thank you.
So the locus classicus of this is James Madison's Federalist Number 55. It's about congressional size. And here's what he says. He says, you need enough folks for so you can trust them and as an anti-corruption device and so they can be representative, but they also have to be able to deliberate and talk with each other. And so there are natural limits. So he says, 50 is going to be better than 5. 5 is too small for your legislature. The executive is 1. He's not as clear a theorist of the executive power as is actually George Washington, who really understands the executive branch because he knows he's going to run it. And he walks away from power, you see, rather than always trying to grasp it, first as disbanding his army and then walking away from the presidency. So all praise to George Washington and frees his slaves on his deathbed and gets better over life. That's not true of Jefferson and Madison on slavery and other things. So 55 says, unity in the executive, multiplicity in the legislature, but what's the number? 5's too small, 50's going to be better. I think he may have done 8 and 80, I can't remember, but I think it's 8 and 8. So 8's too small, 80's going to be better. It's not altogether clear that 800 is going to be better than 80. And it's pretty clear that 8,000 really is not going to be an improvement because you can't talk to each other. So a legislature has natural limits to it if it's to be a place of actually deliberation. Now, maybe the internet makes all sorts of discourse possible that not face-to-face but mediated in various ways through chat rooms and the rest. He says two really interesting other things in Federalist 55. He says, this is a direct quote, had every Athenian been a Socrates, every assembly would still have been a mob. And he actually didn't mean to actually, he was saying literally, if they actually were all philosopher kings, when you have too many people, they can't talk to each other, okay? And Athenian democracy featured more sort of direct participation. The jury that convicts Socrates has 501 persons as opposed to like a standard American jury of 12. So it's all about size. Had every Athenian been a Socrates, every assembly still would have been a mob. So he says the principle of representation is good because you move from basically everyone just sort of shouting over each other in a huge town square, agora or something, to a smaller body where people can talk to each other. And he wants it to be somewhat refined and not just average folks. The end of Federalist 55, to pick up on what Professor Kummiller has told you and what Professor White has told you, is all about civic virtue, which is a key word that Professor White highlighted. So he says, Republican government, government of the people. So whether we call it populist or not, republic, it's the root word is people, public, and as is the people, the people, the people, the people, the people, in Amendments 1, 2, 4, 9, and 10, and we the people in the preamble, and Article 1 begins, representatives are to be chosen by the people. Okay, so whether it's Republican government or the populism or the people, they're cognate ideas, even if not the same idea. He says Republican government presupposes more virtue in ordinary citizens than any other form of government. And if people actually are utterly incapable of anything public-minded, anything virtuous, maybe we're better off hoping for a philosopher king, a benign despot or something. What does he mean? He means ordinary people are supposed to actually inform themselves and read newspapers and deliberate with each other in good faith and obey the laws voluntarily and pay their taxes voluntarily and show up for militia service, even though that's a hassle and dangerous sometimes, and show up for jury duty, even though they'd rather be watching the ball game, and pick the most virtuous among them to be their leaders, and not just someone who looks like them, they want to have a beer with, but it requires more of ordinary citizens in order to work than any other system. And that's what Professor Cunmiller was saying, I think, when she said, you know, are we such a people today? Can we continue to be such a people over 200 years? Because it requires, our system requires a certain, to fill the positions like president and Congress, we need certain kinds of folks, but we also ultimately need a certain kind of people to make the machine work, because we're the hiring committee. You know, and are we willing to do the work and that's all in the Federalist 55, which I encourage you to look at, whose narrow focus is about congressional size. And he says, in effect, 5,000 would be too big.
Well, and that actually brings us to the end of our panel. And so I'd like to certainly thank the panelists. I think this is